me feel very good. I see a lot of familiar faces. We've been doing this for a while. I think this is like, I think I'm maybe the end of year 11 for me. So that means like I've almost been doing this as long as I was like in public schools. That's a little bit frightening. So anyway, of course, many of you have been doing this longer than me. How many of you have been doing this for longer than 12 years? Yeah, a good number of you have. Excellent. All right. Well, you know, typically when y'all see me, I'm here to do the quote heavy lifting on some procedural or substantive legal topics. We're going to shift gears. We're going to get to do something that we don't always get to do that I think you're going to enjoy. A little bit historical, okay, a little bit legal, a little social. Try to give context for issues we're dealing with right now in terms of time. We're talking about the evolution of traffic safety. And this is part of our kind of outreach and awareness, some of the efforts that we're doing with the instance of at the Texas Department of Transportation. Throughout the year, judges have gotten a big kick out of this. We're going to be talking about cars, all right? And as Texans, we have a very, very unique relationship with the automobile. How many of you drove here? Yeah, it's a loaded question. Who didn't? Anybody fly? No, I'm talking about like using your arms as wings. I'm not talking about on an airplane. No, but think about it. Even if you, quote, flew here, you still drove here. I mean, you still rode in a van, right? Texans have a very unique relationship with automobiles, and so do Americans. And just to try to kind of get you into the mindset of what I'm talking about, here is a photograph of my very first automobile, okay? Now, this is a 1968 Oldsmobile Delmont 88, all right? Not to be confused with the highfalutin Delta, we're talking about the Delmont. What a wonderfully awful name, the Delmont. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this car. I inherited this car from my great aunt who died in 1986 when she was 84 years old. I got this because this car had a 425 V8 engine. Okay, got about negative 11 miles to the gallon. It could only be described as being like mascara green in terms of the color. It had no tape deck. Okay, it had air conditioning that worked and worked well, and it was, by any potentially perceived shortcomings from the outside world, the perfect automobile because it was mine. Okay, now, how many of you remember the first time you drove a car? Do you remember it? All right, how many of you remember your first car? I'll tell you what mine was. Let's figure out what type of cars people in this room began driving in. All right, first car. Hit me. It's this side of the room. Well, 65 Mustang. Oh, that's like a cool car. All right, what? 49 Chevy? 65. Y'all had like the same car. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Next row, what we got? 53 Ford? 59 Chevy? Chevy's winning right now, I think. Ooh, Ford Studebaker. All right, over here, this side. Come on, offer up, somebody. I need a witness. Pinto! Said, are you serious? Are you just... one of the Maverick later on, okay? You had a Pinto. Out of your mind. How about this row? Anybody? 41 Plymouth? 72 LTD, all right, 72, good year, it's the year I was born. How about you? 68? 48 Oldsmobile 66, okay, Bruce, what you got? What year? 1960. Volkswagen Beetle Bug? Okay, excellent. All right, think about this. Think of all these cars. Think about the places you wanted to go in these cars. Think about what this car meant to you in your social life. Think about all the things you did in cars that your parents still should not know about. All right. Automobiles. Think about the relationship that we have, and our relationship with automobiles as Texans is very unique. I mean, you're talking about a state that's like 876 miles by 853 miles. You know, I grew up in Vernon, Texas. And growing up in Vernon, you know, if you were lucky enough to have a date on a Saturday night and you wanted to go somewhere, well, you know, if you really liked them, well, if you liked them a little bit, you'd eat local. But if you really liked them, you went to Wichita Falls. All right. So if you now, my wife, who's from Dallas, still has a hard time fathoming it. She goes, "Let me get this straight. You would drive 100 miles round trip for a date." And I was like, "Yeah, and never thought twice about it. Never thought twice about it. People from out in West Texas completely relate to what I'm talking about. You know, there's a Roy Orbison quote that I love. He talked about when he was growing up in Wink. That he never thought twice about driving 200 miles round trip to get a hamburger. You know, that's just the way, you know, look, if you want it, you got places to go, wide open roads, wide open skies, flat terrain, get in the car, grab the keys, go. All right. Now, keep in mind, too, gas was 78 cents a gallon, okay? It would, yeah, how much? Okay, 19 cents is what you're saying when you started? Okay, yeah, 19.9, all right. You know, so, you know, times have changed, but the relationship that we have with these machines has not, okay? You know, I've even thrown up, like, here's a song, I've thrown up the lyrics to a song. This is a Bruce Springsteen song called Open All Night. Check out the lyrics. You can't tell if Springsteen's talking about a relationship he's having with a car or a relationship he's having with a girl, okay? Because it's that intimate for Americans. We love our cars. How many of you love your car right now? You love it. You love your car. You take care of that car. Okay. You know, you probably have cars that you like more than, I don't know, ex-spouses, ex-girlfriends, boyfriends. Enough said. It's a little too early for some of you. You get my point. Okay. We feel passionate about cars. But this is where it gets complicated. Because, you know, it's a double-edged sword. The advent of the automobile changed the world, okay? It's changed our whole concept of from here to there. But, you know, more people have been killed in automobiles than have been killed in all the wars combined. The leading killer of our children. More kids are killed in cars in the United States of America than killed by guns and cancer. That's frightening, okay? It's the double-edged sword. It's the curse of technology. And with every blessing, there comes a curse. So we're going to go ahead and go way back in time. Y'all have got an outline. I'm going to walk you through. We're going to go all the way back. And trust me, I will leave you in a place that will make perfect sense. I'm going to leave you with a conundrum that we're all facing today as judges. Okay? But first, we've got to go way back to really understand how did we get to where we are now in terms of some of the problems that we face with the advent of the automobile. So I'm going to take you back to the year 1771. Okay, how many of you were alive in 1771? Any of you? Anyone? Okay, only Tim. All right. 1771. Nicholas Joseph Cugnot, you know, Americans tend to have a pretty American-centric idea of, you know, who invented the car? We always say, Henry Ford. Wrong. Okay, he invented mass assembly of automobiles. He certainly did not invent the automobile. Okay, there was actually a race to see who could come up with the first automobile, and most of the competition was in Europe. And in 1771, Nicholas Joseph Cugnot did not invent the automobile, but he has a very distinct, important, and maybe somewhat embarrassing claim in world history. Nicholas is the very first person to, as depicted in this photograph, crash an automobile. Okay? Here you go. The first recorded car crash was in 1771. Nicholas Joseph Cugnot crashed this contraption. He had perfected this, you know, this. They had different words, horseless carriage, believe it or not, the locomotive, which I tend to think of as being a train. Okay, this was actually a term that was being used to describe these types of devices. He had perfected the ability to compel himself to make the thing move. He had just overlooked one little small thing that we like to refer to as brakes, the ability to stop it once it started moving. Okay, so he's the first person to believe to have a car crash. In 1865, Great Britain decided it needed to pass a law regulating cars. Now, you might be saying, okay, what? Have I woken up and I'm in West Texas and I'm now listening to some episode of the History Channel? Absolutely. Stick with me. It all makes sense. Okay, plus half of you love the History Channel anyway. Raise your hand. You watch the History Channel? Where are my History Channel people? All right, I got a question. Can you explain to me how ICE Truckers has anything to do with history? Okay, my favorite one, how about Swamp People? Any of y'all watching Swamp People? I told my wife, if we have one more kid, I'm naming that kid Kenwood. I don't care if it's a boy or a girl. And she said, we're not having any more children. Okay, so, all right, 1865 Locomotive Act. Now, I love talking about this, and let me tell you why. Because right now in this state, we are struggling with automotive-related technologies, specifically the relationship we have with our smartphones, okay, and our automobiles. We are seeing some changes. I mean, how many of y'all are aware of the fact that we have a bill that if the governor signs it, will make it a Class C misdemeanor to text while driving or to read a text or to read an email, okay? And I got to say, Power to the people. This is important, okay? It is very important that we start getting on the ball right now. Of course, some people would say that's nanny state. Why do we have to have this? Some of you are saying, I can't believe anyone would actually do this, that they would actually text while driving, okay? And the real problem we've had is we've tried to pass legislation for three sessions now relating to texting while driving or using your cell phone while driving. We can never agree on the language to how to make it work. And y'all know this is true. I see this any of you who have been judges for any period of time know what I'm saying is true. It's easier for the legislature to pass it than sometimes it is to apply it and to make it logically work, okay? You know, so like for instance, we could have a law on distracted driving. But what's distracted driving? Is that eating your hamburger? Is that listening to Garth Brooks a little too loud? What is distracted driving? Those are the reasons why many of these issues don't work out. Well, in 1865, after great debate, they finally passed a law relating to the use of automobiles. Now, look at the law and look at the application. Okay, it's the first traffic law in the world, and it set a speed limit of 2 miles per hour in towns, 4 miles per hour out of town by requiring, I'm not making this up, a man with a red flag to walk 60 yards ahead of qualifying powered vehicles. Okay, why is that? Why would you have to have an entourage, an advance team? Typically, only the President of the United States has an entourage, an advance team. I don't think they like to wave red flags. What do you think the purpose of this is? To not scare pedestrians who have never seen these things, and more importantly, to not scare because there was general consensus in 1865 that cars would never take the place of horses. Okay, horses would always be the accepted mode of transportation. And so, I mean, you basically had to be like, you know, Lady Gaga or Madonna with an entourage waving the red flags. Okay, now, this is where it even gets better. The distance was reduced to 20 yards in 1878. You might want to know why that is. Vehicles, of course, were required to stop on the side of a horse because there were no stop signs. So every time you saw a horse, you had to stop your car. Since the time of Nicholas Cugnot, they had actually developed some brakes. And my absolute favorite part of this law, the speed limit was effectively redundant as vehicles could not exceed the speed at which a person could walk. I want to make sure you're clear. For you who like to get on the treadmill, go ahead and do the math on this. Okay? Think about how far you can walk and now how fast you're walking. 2 miles an hour, is that very fast? It's not very fast. So in other words, the problem we had is that the advance teams were faster than the vehicles that they were advancing. Okay? Application of law to facts. How did this thing work out at the end? It didn't work very well, but it was our first effort to try to pass laws on this. Okay. Any of y'all know who Mary Ward is? 1869. Mary Ward was an amazing woman for any time. She was a scientist. She had a master's degree. She was, you know, a very educated lady, which is very unique in 1869, and she has a real tragic historical place in our discussion because Mary Ward is the very first person who was ever killed in an automobile. She got killed in 1869. Her cousin had invented a thing that was, you know, which was essentially a prototype of an automobile, and while she was riding on, she fell out of the vehicle and was crushed by one of the wheels. Okay, and this was also the first time we noticed that, okay, we see that people who've invented these things don't know how to stop them. In 1869, we start recognizing that we also have problems of people falling out of them and not surviving. Okay, now, if that happened in 1869, you have to wonder, okay, well, it didn't happen in the United States. Actually, I think it happened over in Ireland. Next thing you have to wonder is, how long would it be until the first American was killed? And that brings up this gentleman over here to my right. Okay, this is Henry Bliss, and he was killed on September the 14th, 1899. And he was killed in downtown Manhattan. And on the 100-year anniversary of his death, New York City decided to put a plaque, a memorial, to mark the spot where the very first American was killed in an automobile to try to make Americans think about how many people have been killed since. All right? Because as I've mentioned, it's one of those things, you know. It's so easy. We get in these things every day. We use them to get to where we're going. You know, unless you've really just got a dark side, you probably don't sit there and dwell about the loss of life, the people who have been maimed, the consequences of this to our humanity. But it's a significant milestone to note that this is the first person who was ever killed and how many people have been killed since. Okay, 1895, John Henry Knight. I get a big pick out. This is a picture of him and his wife. This is the very first person to ever receive a ticket. This is first man ever charged with a traffic offense in the United States. He was charged with the offense of using a locomotive without a license, which, of course, would be your, well, I guess, what, your historical precursor to, what, no DL. All right, 1905. Now, curious, how many folks do I have in here who are members of AAA? Got any AAA members? All right, everyone, remember who raised their hand if your car doesn't start after the school's over. These are the people you'll want to track down. You know, when I think about AAA, I think about, you know, roadside service. You know, they'll come bring you gas. They'll come jump your car, all right? I think about the fact that, you know, this is the group that back when I was a kid, you could go down and get maps from them. I'm not so sure, you know, does anyone even have maps now that we're all using our GPSs and our phones and our cars and everything else? But this is the thing that might surprise you. The American Automobile Association, which I consider to be, you know, pretty wholesome and miltose, was actually at one point considered to be a radical organization by the United States Congress. Yeah, seriously. There were members of Congress who described AAA as being a threat, okay, to the future of America. Now, I can understand maybe in 1905, as we get close to like Bolshevik revolution, people being frightened of communists, but AAA, that makes my eyebrows raise. So let me give you the lowdown on this. AAA was opposed to federalization of legislation relating to the operation of cars. They were also opposed to states adopting laws that regulated the use of automobiles. And to a certain degree, a lot of the things that they said are kind of similar to the things that you've heard the NRA talk about before. You know, for instance, should you have to register your automobile? Believe it or not, that was once a very hotly contested issue. Because once you registered your automobile, well, then the government would know who had automobiles and have the ability to tax those automobiles. You know that many states still do this, that they actually, well, we have a vehicle registration. In a lot of states, they have a, you pay an annual tax on your car. It's based off the value, the blue book value of the automobile for that year. Okay, well, this was actually pretty radical. Another thing is, you know, as states were experimenting and trying to implement speed control laws, they thought this was outrageous. There was never an effort to regulate how fast you could go on a horse, okay? And so one of the things they tried to do is they actually opposed any efforts from states to adopt speed laws, speed regulations, and furthermore, the reason why they started handing out maps is because they were the tipsters. One of the things they used to do is they used to, if you were a member of AAA, you could find out where police cars were most likely to be located that were doing speed enforcement, okay? So I think that's funny because just recently, like in the last 12 months, I mean, all this, Senator John McCain spoke out against a person who has developed an app for the iPhone. How many of y'all have heard of the story? Okay, and this app has the ability, every time you see a police officer, you tap the app, and it tells everyone else who has the app that there was a police officer at a certain location at a certain time, and then using the GPS built into your phone, next time you drive in that vicinity, your iPhone will tell you you are in a known area where police officers have been known to do speed trap enforcement, okay? And Senator McCain said that these people should cease and desist, stop selling that app, and I'm not making this up. He described this company as being a threat, okay? Just like Congress at one point in time described AAA as being a threat to the safety and welfare of Americans. All right. Now, 1931, let's get back to how things were playing out in Texas. You can imagine if even folks in Washington, D.C. were of different minds about adopting speed, you know, traffic laws, you can only imagine what's going on back here in Texas, right? In Texas, we actually, for the longest period of time, we were just letting cities and counties do whatever they wanted. Now, I want to talk about this. How many of you have ever seen a stop sign that is square in yellow and has black? And not just at an antique store. You've seen one, haven't you? You know, I remember seeing one in Texas when I was a kid. And later on, it was someone had taken it down, and then I saw it about 15 years later at an antique store in Quanah, Texas. Believe it or not, you know, y'all take these things for granted. You know, if I ask you to describe a stop sign, you're all going to give me the same description, okay? But there was no uniform traffic control devices. There was no standards for what a stop sign had to look like. There was no standards for any of this stuff at one point in time. Well, the state of Texas began adopting. They said, you know, we can't have, you know, what's the law for operating your car in El Paso can't be different than what the law is going to be when operating your car in Eastland. And so what happened is the state of Texas began gradually adopting uniform laws for the entire state. A lot of members of the Texas legislature opposed this, so what they began doing is, as these laws were getting passed, they decided that they would make it almost impossible, if not impracticable, for a peace officer to ever enforce them. So let's talk about what some of the laws were in about 1928, 1929, okay? Which was that you could only enforce a traffic law if at the time of the offense, the person who was committing the offense could see the peace officer in plain view, okay? The officer had to be in plain view. Additionally, the peace officer had to, this is my favorite part of the bill, had to be properly dressed, had to be wearing a uniform with a with pants, had to be properly creased down the center, had to have the right color shirt, had to have the badge on the right side of their uniform, had to be wearing, had to have a kerchief, okay? Sounds less like a traffic law and more like an episode of Fashion Police to me. But this is exactly what the law was. It was designed, in effect, to make it impossible for peace officers to enforce traffic laws that were being adopted by the Texas legislature. This case, this issue, made it to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1931, and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals shot down that statute as being a violation of separation of powers. They explained that it's the role of the legislature to create the offenses, and it's the role of law enforcement to police and to enforce those laws. It is not the job of the legislature to micromanage the way in which peace officers do their job. Now, the funny thing is, this might sound ridiculous to some of you. You know, if you think about it, you know, for different points of time, do you remember like when Texas adopted their seatbelt law, some of the attitudes that still some people had about seatbelt use? Do you remember that? I mean, you know, I've heard stories about what it was like at some of these judges' schools. You know, judges being all bent out of shape that they've actually going to make us wear the seatbelt. Some of the judges saying they would never enforce that law and they would always find people not guilty because you've got the right not to wear your seatbelt. Now, fast forward to where we are now. How many of you have grandchildren? Small children in your lives. Make your presence known. Okay. And let me ask you something. Those kids, do they think their seatbelts? Heck, my son Liam, he acts like he was stunned the first time, snapping himself in. Mom or dad started the car, but then we threw it in reverse to come out before he was completely buckled in. He freaked out. He didn't think the car moved unless he was properly restrained. Okay, that's the evolution of traffic safety. That is just a fundamental difference. You know, let me ask you this: How many of you condone texting while driving? Any of y'all condone this? Any of you think it's a good idea? You condone it? You like that idea of texting and driving? No, okay. No, but let me ask you this. When you poll people between the ages of 16 and 25, would it shock you if I were to tell you that a statistically significant number of them think it's okay? That's the distinction. The people who've been driving for a longer period of time, who also know that they're not, you know, they accept their mortality, recognize that this is not a good idea. Okay? Whereas these other folks, they're punching buttons from the time they wake up, from the time they go to bed, and they might not know what to do if they actually had to watch the road. Okay? That's where we are on the evolution of traffic safety. Okay, now, 1930, Clara Strait, C.J. Strickland, these are pioneers of automobile safety, who were the first to describe cranial and facial injuries caused by car wrecks. Excuse me, they advocated the use of padded dashboards and seat belts. Now, these were both physicians who had noticed something. And these are things that some of you are painfully familiar with, and I literally mean painfully familiar, which is that back in the 1930s, and this continued for a period of time, okay, when these automotive makers were designing these cars, they tended to have a real proclivity towards making laden dashboards that were shiny and pretty. Okay, with absolutely zero thought of what would happen if someone's knee, elbow, or face were to go slamming into that dashboard. Because keep in mind, there were no seat belts. All right, So I've been asking this question at every conference I've spoken at this year. Okay, who in here has at least one scar on their body that was inflicted off of a dashboard? Anybody? There we go. My mom, she has like matching scars on the left and right hand side of her knee from like where her knees got cramped up in the dashboard. She was involved in the when she was like a senior or freshman in college, okay? Almost everyone of a certain generation has these types of injuries, okay? Now, these were the first people to talk about this, but of course it would be one of the themes that you're going to see as we go through our timeline is that from the point of recognition to the point of change, there is a lag, okay? From the point that someone says, Houston, we have a problem, to the point that we actually do something about the problem, there is a lag. And tragically, a lot of people end up getting maimed, killed, or injured, okay? It's just the way these things evolve. I want you to think about attitudes towards, drinking and driving. I mean, heck, I've already told you, I was born in 1972. I clearly remember I knew people who got DWIs. It wasn't a good thing, but it certainly wasn't the end of the world, okay? Today, a DWI is the scarlet letter in certain circles. I mean, y'all know what I'm talking about? The way that you've seen the penalties go up? How many of y'all remember when DWI was a fine-only offense? A lot of you remember when it was a fine-only offense. Okay? Today, in certain circles, it's the scarlet letter. Okay? Things change. There's a lag. All that away. You're going to see it's a recurring theme. 1934, General Motors performs their first crash test. These, of course, are not 1934 cars. I will tell you, however, 1934, when they did this, the response from Ford and from Chrysler was, why are you crashing like perfectly operating automobiles? There was a complete loss as to why there was any utility in crashing perfectly operating automobiles. 1940, U.S. government adopts its first equipment regulation on automobiles, and I'm going to ask you to go ahead and to guess the regulation. This is the first time that the federal government has told the car makers, you absolutely, positively will not be allowed to sell an automobile in the United States of America unless it has this equipment on the automobile. What was it? Horns, lap belts, what else? Windshield wipers. And I heard the correct answer, yes. The correct answer, headlights. Okay, now this ought to tell you something too. What I'm telling you is from the advent of the automobile until 1940, headlights were completely optional. How do you think this affected traffic safety? You know, I remember as a kid, my great-grandmother, who was born in 1899, used to talk about she would never, ever allow anyone in the family to drive after sundown. I never understood why that was. Maybe now I get it a little bit better. Okay, because prior to the year 1940, some of the automobile makers made them, but they didn't have to make them. And you didn't have to have them. And in many states, you weren't required to have them. And my favorite is that they weren't uniform. This is the design that many of you are familiar with, okay? This is the design that many of you have been frustrated with. I'm sure you remember what it was like to change these headlights. This was the design that essentially was the norm. And I think until halogen bulbs in a different type of assembly became commonly accepted. You remember what these things were like when you would have to change them? You know, sometimes your car was never quite the same. You'd be driving down the road at night, you could see these cars that have the headlamps. You remember like this? The headlamps would be like, kind of angled like this or like that. They were a pain to change. And quite often, I remember this, I had a grandmother who said that she'd always tell her husband it was time to get a new car after when the headlights went out, it'd be time to get a new car because they were never the same in terms of having the perfect alignment of those headlights. All right. Well, get this. Prior to the advent of when that notion of headlights were invented, there was a debate about how many should you have? Should you only have one? Where should you put it? How should it be powered? Some people were saying that you should have kerosene-powered headlamps, that was the way to do this, was to use kerosene. We take this thing for granted that when you get in a car, it's going to have headlights, that the headlights are going to help keep you safe, that you're going to be able to see where you're going. Not so prior to the 1940s. All right, now, 1942, Hugh DeHaven, who survives an airplane crash in which he is the only survivor. He has survivor's guilt, and he's haunted by the fact why everyone in that airplane died, but he lived. So he begins studying collisions. And he's studying why it is that some people live and some people die. And he writes a complete study on the effect of blunt trauma on the human body. And he gets this idea that maybe, he concludes in his report that the reason why he lived while his friends died was because of the fact that the part of the airplane he was in was reinforced by what would be described now as a crash cage. Okay, so he has this idea of what if we were to take these crash cages and put them into cars? What if we built a car around a frame that was designed to keep you safe? He took this idea to the big three car makers, and they laughed at him. It was universally rejected. Why would we ever want to put a feature from an airplane in an automobile? And his answer was, because it will keep you alive if you crash. That was not where the point of focus was in 1942 in Michigan. Okay, the big car makers were not looking at keeping you safe and keeping you alive. What were they looking at? Selling cars, and how did they look, and what was the next one going to look like? Okay, completely a real strong focus on aesthetics. But hold this thought, because Hugh was not done. Okay, he was not done. 1948, Preston Tucker comes up with an automobile that has many of the features that had been talked about, that we've already talked about so far. He was the first person to have a car with a lap belt, had a padded dashboard, had a safety glass. Had the debate about how many headlights should you have. Preston said you should have three, okay? On top of that, he actually had a, and by the way, I'm curious, how many of you have actually ever seen a Tucker torpedo before? Have y'all ever seen one? I just saw on my way back from San Antonio, Hope and Mark, that there is a place out in San Marcos that this guy, he has a billboard on I-35. He's got a whole car museum and his crown jewels. He has a Tucker torpedo if anybody wants to go see it. Now, one of the things that the Tucker torpedo had was it had pulleys attached to the steering wheel so that when you turn the wheel, headlights would move in alignment to where the steering wheel was aligned. Now, this too was also laughed at. But if any of y'all watch any TV, you may have noticed that Mercedes-Benz now is very proud of the fact that they have a laser-guided system that will align your headlights based off of the where you have that steering wheel turn. Okay, this guy was way ahead of his times, and as y'all know, the car wasn't perfect; it was underpowered. Okay, he didn't have, and many of the cars that were made actually never had engines, and ultimately the big three crushed him to make sure he never had a chance to compete with them. All right. 1949, back to Hugh DeHaven, okay? Hugh finally convinces automobile maker Saab, okay? Crash cage has an idea, and here is the very first automobile ever made that has... Crash cages are now commonly accepted, crumple zones are now commonly accepted, but back in 1949, this was a crazy idea that you had to go sell to Europeans because there were no Americans who were buying, okay? Now, on top of that, I get a kick out of this car for a couple of reasons. First, check out the location of the handle. It's an interesting location. Another thing I get a kick out of is Saab. Saab, as many of you know, was ultimately purchased by GM. Okay, and the other thing that you may not, or you may remember if you watch a lot of TV, is that the ad campaign that Saab has been using, I don't know if they've discontinued it because I have not seen it recently, but in the last 3 years, their whole motto has been Born from Jets. There, how many of you have heard that Born from Jets is part of the ads that they have? That Born from Jets campaign is actually all based off of Hugh DeHaven and his work about trying to transpose ideas that we got from airplanes about keeping people safe to bringing them in. By the way, if you also notice, next time you find Southwest Airlines, take a look at the seat belts that you have on those airplanes and then compare them to those that you think about the ones you first saw in cars when they started selling them. Another design. The lift lid, lap belt, another idea that was co-opted from airplanes. All right, now, 1956, you'll be safer in a Ford, okay? Ford decides that they're going to try to sell safety. And I know this is small. I love these old classic ads, okay? I love the look of these cars. This is very Americana. You know, you get the feeling for these type of things. So, okay, you've got the lifeguard steering wheel that will actually flex in the event of a car wreck. Most people who were being killed in the 1950s were actually being killed by the steering wheel, were being killed because of internal trauma that occurred when they would hit the steering. People were being impaled on their steering wheels. Okay. The optional lifeguard padded dashboard. You know, some people, if you want, it's optional because a lot of people, you might like the look of that aluminum. The aluminum that will be there to knock your teeth out when you hit the dashboard because you decided you didn't want to pay for the seatbelt. My favorite one is the lap belt, and of course the doors that are designed to stay closed in the event of a car wreck. Now I want you to think about this. Can you imagine someone saying, hey, I want to sell you a car, and for a little extra money, we'll sell you a door that is designed to stay closed when you have a car wreck? You would probably, laugh your way right off of the car dealership lot and say, that guy is crazy as hell, because you wouldn't buy a car that you had to pay extra money for a door designed to stay closed. This shows you the mindset. Now, this thing was a failure for the Ford Motor Company. Edsel Ford is quoted as stating, during this last year, the other companies have been busy making profit, selling cars, busy selling safety. And we've got to get back to our basics. We got to sell cars, not safety. Sell cars. That's what we do, is we sell cars. All right, so this idea was a complete failure. I don't know. Maybe it was the fact that they were using a bear. Maybe it was a bear. Bears work well for fire safety, but not well for selling traffic safety. I don't know. But classic ad, the 1956 Ford. All right, now, 1958, the United Nations World Forum for Harmonization of Vehicle Regulations issues a recommendation that all cars be equipped with the invention of this gentleman, okay, the three-point safety belt. Now, the three-point safety belt was ultimately embraced by Volvo, okay? They celebrated the anniversary. A photograph of the inventor, Mr. Bolin there, who invented the three-point safety belt. Their response in the United States of America is essentially, y'all can guess based off the times, that the United Nations, some people thought that they, we're not, this is world order attempt. This is some big brother attempt. Stay out of the business, the United States of America, communist, pinko, socialists. And the whole idea of a call for a uniform global standard for seatbelts was rejected in the United States of America. All right, but of course, you might notice, even though there was a lag between 1958, every one of you who have a car are using a three-point shoulder belt. All right, 1959, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety was created. Now, let me tell you what you're looking at here. You are looking at a collision between a 2009 Chevrolet Malibu and a 1959 Chevrolet Impala, okay? And here is what is, they did this to celebrate the anniversary of the IIHS. Here's what's so notable about this. Though those cars, we have this notion, they don't build them like they used to. Well, guess right. Damn tootin' is all. What we've learned is that when they crashed these two cars together, that the person who was involved, who was in this 2009 Malibu, would walk away, and this person who was in this vehicle would be taken away in parts, because the interior of the car was essentially, experienced the same amount of trauma that you would experience if you were hit by an improvised explosive device, okay? The amount of steel, glass, combustible fluid, okay, things that could burn. These were, because back then, as we talked about, in 1959, where was the focus? The focus was on the aesthetic. In 2009, where's the focus? The focus is on safety. Okay, not just looks, but safety. All right. 1964, Volvo develops its first rear-facing child safety seat. Okay, now I want you to think about this. This is 1964. 1964, they developed their first rear-facing child safety. Oh, what year Texas began requiring Texans to use child safety seats? I don't know, because I recently found a picture of my mom and dad when they brought me home it looked like they were literally carrying me in a piece of, I don't know, it looked like something that could only be described as something you would either play with on the beach and put sand in it, made by Tupperware. It had like a white plastic handle. It had no way to be mounted on the seat. How many of you had kids in the 1970s, and when you took them home in these plastic things? You couldn't even describe them as having any safety. You know, it was more like, a plastic carrying case for your child, okay? Contrast that to now. I mean, Judge Phillips has said, you know, we had another baby this year. And, you know, and with this baby, just this baby, there was no way. They weren't letting us out of that hospital until they knew we had a child safety seat and that it was installed. I clearly remember when Liam was born back in 2005, I naively thought I could just go downstairs and put that thing in the car. It's July in Texas. It's like 142 degrees inside that car. It's like a blast furnace. I'm in there with my knee in there, wedged in there. I spent an hour and 20 minutes trying to slay the devil before I actually got that thing properly installed. I come back upstairs. Honey, I'm ready to go. I look like I'm all sweating, like I've taken a shower in there because I've been in there fighting the child safety seat. Our standards have changed, you know. Just like you see people smoking in the hospital, okay? Things have changed, all right? But, you know, it's just amazing to see the lag between the time that this is developed and the time it's implemented. More on this in a second. Okay. 1965. The book Unsafe at Any Speed is released, you know, this written by Ralph Nader. Now, I know for many of you, some of you still might have some hard feelings against Ralph because of that presidential election. But to his credit, and if you get a chance, for those of you who are on Netflix, there is an awesome documentary about Ralph Nader. His legacy may be highlighted to a certain degree by what he's done politically. But, you know, there really wouldn't be traffic safety in the United States of America if it wasn't for this guy. This book was seminal. It was a tipping point. This is the point in time in which he's able to show that General Motors knows that there is a design flaw in the rear axle of the Corvair. They're able to show that they know for a fact that if this car, because it's got this pivoting rear axle, that, you know, had a center hinge point, if you're driving and you go on the road and one wheel goes off, you're going to have the car, the rear axle, on two different planes. And guess what that means? It means fun time in the world of physics, because your odds of getting flipped right on over under those types of circumstances. General Motors actually tries to destroy Ralph Nader by sending out an army of prostitutes to try to entrap him in a compromising, embarrassing sexual situation that they can use to get leverage on the guy, okay? The chairman of General Motors is brought before Congress and has to testify before Bobby Kennedy and has to take the Fifth Amendment when he's asked about vice counsel, Fifth Amendment. They honestly, they ended up admitting fault and having to apologize to Ralph Nader. All right, now, This is a big deal. He did sue them, and won. And then he gave the money to start up his own nonprofit. Something Citizen. I'm stroking out on the name of his organization. Public Citizen. All right, now, this is a turning point, because what we see next is in 1966, we now have a couple of things. We see that Congress mandates automobiles. We see that seat belts, for the first time, are going to be required equipment. Now, I want you to go back on that. What was the first piece of required equipment? Headlights. How many years passed before they required seat belts? 26 years? Okay? And even then, this is stuff that they required that they put in it. This is when you start seeing the lap belts pop up. There's not even the three-point restraints. This Department of Transportation is created. 1970, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is created. Now, you know, the Department of Transportation, they're the ones who get to certify standards. Like, for instance, you hear about issues about motorcycle operators. They're required to wear a helmet. Okay? The helmet is not certified. A motorcycle helmet that they bought at a flea market that's not certified. Because a DOT certified helmet has to go through certain standards to pass before it can be sold on the market. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, of course, is subsidizing us being here today. Also has had a big impact in terms of increasing, you know, the clicker-to-ticket campaigns throughout the United States of America. 1974, back to car design for a second. The Mini Clubman experimental safety vehicle is made. This is a car that has what they call a pedestrian-friendly front end. And a lot of folks, you know, you might think this is kind of a funny-looking car, but I'll tell you something. Since 2002 or 2003, there hasn't been a single Honda manufactured that does not have a pedestrian-friendly front end. What I'm talking about is that older cars were either designed to either pull, you know, not designed to, but because of their design, they had what were called noses, or bullet front ends, in which the person who was hit by the car would pull directly in to the manifold or pulled underneath the automobile. A pedestrian-friendly front end is designed to pull someone over, so they'll actually roll up onto the front of the car instead of being pulled underneath the automobile. All right. 1975, NTSB is created. Notice, this is all after the unsafe at any speed stuff kind of comes through, the impact of Nader's work. When do you hear about NTSB? You never want to hear about NTSB, do you? You don't want to hear NTSB on the news, because when NTSB is mentioned, it typically means what? Plane crash, train crash, bus crash, any form of commercial crash, NTSB is going to be on it. All right. 1978, Volvo introduces its first booster seat. Okay? This is my son Liam. This is Iron Man. Okay, now, I want to talk to you again about, just to show you, solution traffic safety. How many remember as a kid standing up on the front seat of a car while an adult drove? And how many of you have seen, or how many of you are guilty of having used what my mom used to do, the old mother arm guard. Like you're going to be able to suspend the rules of physics to keep your giblet child from flying through the dash. All right. Now let's go one step further than this. I remember as a kid not only doing that, I remember as a kid, you know, my grandparents lived in El Dorado, Oklahoma, and we used to go over to Altus. Okay, how many of y'all know where Altus, Oklahoma is? You know where that is? We used to go over to Altus. We'd come back to El... How many of y'all know where El Dorado, Oklahoma is? That's even a bigger one. Anyone know where El Dorado is? Okay, all right. It's not too late to learn. All right, close to Quanah, okay, other side of the Red River. And I used to crawl out of the front seat, into the back seat, out of the back seat, into the rear windshield, and I would lay down. And my feet would be at one end, my head would be at the other end, and I would stare up from the rear windshield up into the stars of heaven. Okay, how many of you have done that, or you know people have done that? Okay. Now, I want you to think about what would happen today if you were driving a car and you had your grandson, your child, to crawl up in the back of a car windshield. You are going to jail, my friends. You're not going to get a ticket. Maybe you will, because you're a judge, but you're going to go to jail. That's child endangerment, okay? Evolution of traffic safety. It's a real deal, okay? Now, back to this thing about how things change. We talk about booster seats, all right? 1978 is the year that the rear booster seat is invented by Volvo. We know that kids don't fit seat belts. Little kids don't. They're designed for adults, all right? So we know that if we get enough lift on them, that we can accommodate them and make the seat belt work by getting a certain amount of lift on these kids. Now, here's my question to you, though, okay? What year did Texas adopt a booster seat law? Nope. Try 2009. Last session. Okay? Now that's stunning, but that's one of the carryaways. As judges, you need to understand how these things work. The event happens. We gather the data. We know. And change occurs. That's one of the recurring themes. All right. 1979, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration begins crash testing popular cars and putting stickers on this. Americans start demanding to know if the cars they're driving are safe. This is the first time ever, beginning in the 1970s and 80s, that Car and Driver and Motor Trend does not sell as many issues of its magazines as Consumer Reports does of its annual car issue. Okay? People want to know, are these cars safe? 1984, the first state in the union adopts a seatbelt law. What year was seatbelts required to be installed in cars? 1966, right? Okay, 1984, New York is the very first state in the union to adopt a seatbelt. Okay, now, this is the thing that's kind of stunning. Every state in the union has adopted a seatbelt law since, with the exception of New Hampshire, where their motto is live free or die. okay? 1986, federal government requires rear-mounted backing lights, brake lights, okay? You know, this is one of those things I don't even think I ever picked up on. But this has saved lives, too, and it's reduced the number of rear-end collisions. And if you're really lucky, you can have a Batman light. Okay, now, 1989. Passive restraints required for automobiles. There was a choice given to the automakers. You could either use airbags or you could use this dreaded monster. How many of you remember this bad boy? The automated track seat belt, okay? This goes down as one of the worst inventions in automotive history. I have a friend who sells cars for scrap. He goes, even junk car dealers don't want these things, okay? These were the bad boys that this thing would go up on an automated rail, you know, okay, and then you still had to put on your lap belt. Of course, a lot of people didn't, which meant that they ended up getting clotheslined when they were involved in car wrecks. Okay, not a good idea. And of course, my favorite thing is this. You could disconnect this and then give yourself a perfect target to slam your head into when you're involved in a car wreck. Okay, 1998, dual airbags are required in automobiles. Okay, we are now dealing with third generation airbags, smart airbags. They know how much the people weigh. They know if there's no one in the seat. They know when they need to go off. They know when they don't need to go off. I bought a 2006 Honda. The car has a total of 8 airbags in the car. There are 8 airbags in a small car. Okay, airbag technologies change things. 1995, IHS begins frontal offset crash tests. This is an offset crash test between a 2009 Mercedes C300 and a 2009 Smart for Two. Doesn't look too smart for me at this very moment. 2003, they begin conducting side impact crash tests. I don't mean to beat up here, no pun intended, on a smart car, but this is a smart car being hit from side impact, and this is actually a smart car as well. It also kind of resembles something you would expect to be sitting on the curb of your neighbor's yard on oversized garbage haul-away day. Okay. 2004, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration releases new data on rollover risk. Now, this is important. Listen up to me on this, even if you've already faded out, okay? This is a big deal in Texas because we actually lead the nation in rollover deaths because of a myth that many of you, okay? How many of you put your kid in your Suburban, you put him in your Yukon, you put him in your Explorer? How many of you did it? Yeah, a lot of people did it. Guess what? They're not safer. Your daughter would be safer in a Ford Escort than she would be in the Suburban. Now, maybe head-on collisions, but here's what we've learned. Suburbans, Yukons, SUVs, the rollover factor is high, and when you've got someone in that car who's been driving for less than 5 years, that actually is multiplied times 4. So the number of young adolescent males killed in pickup trucks in Texas that are turning over, now y'all all know this too. Putting a kid in a pickup truck is a dangerous thing anyway, because if you don't have enough rear weight in the back of that bed, how many of you have ever tried to drive that pickup truck on an icy road when there's no weight in the rear of that bed? It's scary, isn't it? It's a scary thing. All right. Well, this is one reason why y'all saw TxDOT in this campaign of trying to get people to actually think of these things as riding. Did y'all see it's like, you know, make sure you buckle up when you're driving your SUV, and they had this campaign of showing this guy riding this SUV like it's a wild bull, like at a rodeo. Remember seeing those PSAs? That was the whole focus of this. Okay. It's especially important now because of the fact that we're seeing that distracted driving in Texas is starting to kill people big time. Y'all need to know this, the golden rule. First 500 hours of driving, the young adults, and you are going to see them in your court. They're the ones who are subject to all these probationary driver's license features. They don't get it, but you need to. Okay, it's not about fines. It's about safety. The first 500 hours behind the wheel, a child or a young driver is more likely to kill themselves, kill someone else, injure themselves, or injure someone else. It's the golden rule, the first 500 hours behind the wheel. Okay? I love this one. It begs the question, are we any safer? This is actually outside of our office. Someone took over this TxDOT billboard, and this was Katie Teff's first day of work. And when she came to work, you turn into our parking lot, and this is what she got to read. Caution, zombies ahead. Okay, it is. It's right next to our office in Austin. And the answer is, are we any safer? And that brings us to this notion of risk compensation. And this is where I'm going to, this is where I conclude, and I bring everything in to put the car in park. Y'all, just digest this. Risk compensation is a phenomenon in which, as people think they are safer, they engage in behaviors that are less safe. Said, in other words, if you think you're in danger, you're more likely to engage in behaviors to keep you safe, but when you think you are safer, you're more likely to engage in behaviors that put you at risk. Ponder that for a second, because that's exactly what's happened. See, what's happened, my friends, is your cars have gotten safer. The human condition has not changed. We still deal with the psychology of risk compensation. In other words, why do your kids think it's okay to text, chew gum, put on their eye makeup, listen to the radio, flip through radio stations? Why do they think that's okay? Because they don't think that the tires on their car are about to blow out. They don't think they're about to get T-boned. They don't think that someone's about to run that red light. And because they feel safer in their automobiles, they're actually more at risk. That's the great paradox of this entire topic. Cars are safer. The human condition has not changed. We still engage in behavior that's associated with risk compensation. Let me show you what this looks like. Okay, what this means is that even when you take into consideration population, the United States leads Great Britain, Canada, Australia, all the industrialized nations in the number of people who are being killed and who are being seriously injured in automobiles. And though we're making progress, our problem still is, right now, the big hot-button issue is wireless communication devices and phones. We are at the very beginning of the discussion about wireless communications devices in our cars, just like we would be if the car was invented at the same point in time in which bourbon was invented. Okay? How do these two things go together? How do they relate to each other? What's the effect? You watch. You know, I guarantee you, grandchildren will probably have a completely different attitude about using cell phones or wireless communication devices, or by that point in time it might be implanted chips in their brains, than your kids and grandkids do today. All right, folks, that's my time. I enjoyed it. I will talk to you later. And make sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and on YouTube. Thank you.